Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be catching up with Adam Boileau in just a moment to talk through all the week's security news, and then we will be hearing from this week's sponsor. And this week's sponsor is Casada. They run a bot traffic mitigation service that is actually becoming very popular. They just did a Series B raise. And the big announcement for them this week is that former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull kicked in $1 million investment and joined their board. For those of you who don't know, maybe some of our listeners outside of Australia wouldn't know, Turnbull is rich, so which is why he can casually kick $1 million into a cybersecurity company. Anyway, this week's sponsor guest is Casada's chief executive, Pascal Podvin, and we'll be having a bit of a chat with him about how things are going for them. That is coming up later, but first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with Adam Boileau. And Adam, Australia in the headlines globally over the last week.
Yes, the Australian Prime Minister came out and said that a state actor of some sort has been going after all sorts of Australian entities, you know, government agencies and companies and private sector and all sorts of things, did a big press release, got quite a lot of media coverage in Australia and over here in New Zealand as well. And then the details and the attribution weren't exactly what everyone wanted in that. There wasn't much. But then subsequently, the Australian Cybersecurity Centre followed up with some, you know, indicators of compromise and some other technical bits and pieces. And sure enough, kind of looks like China.
Yes, it does. So there's a lot going on here, right? So initially there was the press conference and, people were a little bit underwhelmed because Morrison didn't name China. But it was actually the prudent thing to do, in my view, because every time you even come close to naming them, all of a sudden Australian export ships wind up held up in ports in China because of permit problems or something, right? Now, keep in mind, we're not like the United States. We can't really decouple from China. Some estimates put our exports to China at 38% of our exports, right? Our next closest trading partner is Japan. That's at around 10%. And a lot of that is raw materials that get turned into like steel and then sent to China. So the true measure of China's, you know, consumption of Australian materials, minerals, whatever, it's absolutely massive. So we can't really take the same attitude as other countries. But what they did is, you know, the Australian government officials were furiously backgrounding people that it was China, right? Like, so that's what they do. They just don't do it. They just don't do it publicly. This led to a really interesting conversation on Twitter that I had with a couple of ASPI people, actually, from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. And they were saying to me, come on, do you really think it makes a difference that they didn't directly attribute, but they're doing all this backgrounding? And I replied with one-word answer, which was yes. And then 2 hours later, the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs blamed ASPI for pointing the finger at China because, Peter Jennings of ASPI had actually done a couple of interviews where he said, well, clearly they're talking to China. So China was able to save face by saying, you know, this is all coming from ASPI, which takes money from American defense contractors and something, something great Satan. But they were able to save face. So that's all well and good. Now, the real story here appears to be that there has just been a steady gradual uptick in Chinese APT related activity into Australia from the MSS, and that it has picked up a little bit more than usual since Australia-backed calls for an inquiry into the origins of COVID-19. So that appears to be the story in a nutshell. We've seen the Australian Financial Review report that the government here will introduce a set of mandatory minimum standards for InfoSec standards for the private sector to meet. Then again, our sources are saying that it won't be as severe as what the media is reporting here. And we had a really interesting little diversion when looking into this story. Initially, the Sydney Morning Herald reported that a intrusion into Transport for New South Wales into their systems was linked to this and was part of the reason why the Prime Minister did this big press conference, right? And we don't believe that to be accurate. We believe that that was a very small sort of limited intrusion, probably attempted ransomware. But where things get interesting is when Brett reached out to ask the New South Wales government about these intrusions into the New South Wales state government, they referred us to the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet saying that it was a national security issue. So we're not quite sure what's going on there, but I will remind listeners that back in April, there was an intrusion into essentially Australia's DMV for New South Wales, where a bunch of people got spearfished. And this hit the media like it was a big deal. And we were on the show saying, why is this a big deal? A handful of 0365 accounts got compromised. But if that attack was tied back to the MSS, that would make a lot of sense, because that's the sort of target they'd go after to get personal details, addresses and things for, you know, Chinese nationals living in Australia. So, look, there's a lot to unpack here, right?
Yeah, no, it's certainly, you know, a twisty, turny maze of stories, and the, you know, the history, I guess, or the, you know, the of intrusion by Chinese actors into various bits of the Australian, you know, kind of private and public sectors, you know, going back the last few years. I mean, some of these IOCs do have quite long tales, you know, where we've seen similar activity and tradecraft around the place. And of course, you know, Morrison coming out and saying, you know, this is, you know, sophisticated nation state activity from the point of view of the tradecraft. I mean, you know, some of the technical IOCs do suggest it's a little more common garden, but hey, it works. And, you know, the fact that it's, you know, being directed by the Chinese towards Australians as the, you know, kind of tension overall is a bit higher.
I think that's actually what they mean when they say sophisticated, is that it's a sophisticated operation. I mean, people always say, oh, there's nothing sophisticated about this. Of course there is. It's operationally sophisticated. It doesn't mean they're using amazing bags of O'Day, right?
Although there is some interesting use of, you know, like things that specifically target Office 365. You know, the things that are pretending to be specifically Australian, like mail filtering software, for example, which, yeah, that, you know, that's kind of sophisticated in terms of the operational aspect.
Yeah, so they were pretending to be MailGuard 365, which is a popular mail filtering service here. They actually cooked up a malicious Azure app, which you could OAuth, right? And of course, you are authenticating to a genuine 0365 page to give this thing access. And it's, you know, it's the ultimate way to fish people and bypass MFA is these Azure apps. And they are everywhere. I mean, I'm hearing from multiple sources that these Azure app campaigns are just everywhere right now. Now, Microsoft, look, the details are in this week's newsletter, so go read that for the details. But basically, you can't really do much about that unless you give Microsoft all of your money for an E5 license.
Yeah,
so they are getting all of their customers owned, right? Like, and these are this is being exploited by foreign intelligence services, right? So, I mean, think of all the American companies and government departments that are getting hosed this way. And Microsoft has the features to fix this and is charging money for it. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft O365 licensing has kind of been a sore point, you know, in terms of security features for a long time. I mean, it used to be that, you know, even multi-factor auth was kind of gated behind some of these upper tier, you know, service levels for a while. At least that's a bit better now. But yeah, OAuth controls, some of the other more sophisticated detection stuff, you have to be, you know, really paying quite a lot of money per user month to get that. And, you know, it's not a great look for Microsoft and for confidence in the platform.
One other funny aspect to all of this is when the Australian Security Cybersecurity Centre actually released IOCs that included, like, localhost listeners.
Oh, dear. Well, I mean, so long as no one, you know, automatically just, you know, puts IOCs into their stuff and, you know, has no humans looking at it.
Because nobody does that, right?
No, nobody would just, you know, blindly ingest them and run them and start blocking stuff. That would never happen.
It's so funny. A friend of ours was actually scrolled it a bit too quick and thought they saw a MAC address in there. So I tweeted that. and, you know, with a scream gif saying, you know, the attacker is in the building. But it turns out they were actually just scrolling too fast and it wasn't a MAC address. Look, there's plenty of details in this. Brett did an absolutely amazing job writing this up. You read his coverage, right?
Yeah, no, it is very well explained.
Yeah, so go to the site risky.biz or into the show notes for a direct link to this week's newsletter, which, you know, generally speaking, gets published after the newsletter's been out. There's quite a delay there, so you might want to subscribe to the newsletter. You can find the links on risky.biz. And big thanks. We've got our first sponsor for the weekly newsletter, which is AutoMox. Dmitry Alperovich joined the board of AutoMox and suggested they'd make a good sponsor. And yeah, they do like cloud-based patching, right, which quite a few of you need given what's happening with COVID and work from home and stuff. And yeah, their solution looks like a pretty reasonable one. So you can check them out, and yeah, details in the newsletter. But geez, let's move on to some more stories, otherwise we'll be talking about that one all day. But look, here's another example of Microsoft hiding a security feature behind E5 licenses, which is their safe documents feature, which looks really useful, right? They're like, hey, people are getting owned through deficiencies in our products. We're going to charge you this massive licensing fee so that you can access this feature that like tries to take away some of the pain that we're inflicting on you. Is that about right?
That's pretty much it. I mean, this is the like the Office 365 cloud equivalent of the like protected mode that we used to have in you know, kind of Edge client Office that will also ship off documents to get them scanned before it'll let you take it out of protected mode. So it's quite a sensible feature. It's a thing that people would want. But yeah, gating it behind, once again, the E5 license so everybody else can get owned by, you know, macros and that sort of thing in the year 2020 AD.
Yeah, I mean, it only costs a gazillion dollars, right? So as far as Microsoft is concerned, the choice is yours. But look, some big news that just broke as we were prepping this week's run sheet is there is now, it looks like there's a bill coming in the United States that takes aim at, encrypted messenger services and things like locked iPhones and whatnot. You know, we've been predicting this would come for a while. Lindsey Graham is one of the backers of this bill, so it's not just coming from a bunch of nobodies. There is so far no bill text, but we do have a press department here hosted on the Senate Judiciary website, and it's pretty serious stuff by the looks of things.
Yeah, I mean, it really lines up with what we saw Senator Graham saying, you know, last year sometime, you know, where the tech companies basically are going to be told to just do, you know, just fix it. We don't care about your dumb nerd shit. Just make this how it is. And this seems to be where this is going, right? That there's going to be some requirement for, you know, vendors that have, you know, crypto in play to be able to just, you know, be served a warrant and make the data appear. And no one wants to know exactly how and why. There's a few other bits as well, like, you know, kind of encouraging innovation and, you know, developing ways to do this safely and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, that's the real guts of it is, you know, they are going to be issued a warrant and we'll have to comply. Otherwise, bad stuff will happen, which is, you know, a very blunt instrument. It does, the lawmakers aren't going to be trying to prescribe how the tech will work, which, you know, hasn't gone well in the past. So that's, you know, I guess if you're looking for a positive, that's it. But yeah, could be quite a big deal.
Well, one interesting part here is the bill will allow the Attorney General to issue directives to service providers and device manufacturers to report on their ability to comply with court orders, including timelines for implementation. So what looks on first read to be modelled kind of on Australia's assistance and access bill, actually when you get to that part, you realise they're going a whole lot further because, yeah, the AA bill, yeah, nothing like that in there.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, that was going to be kind of, you know, triggered when the government actually wanted something and, you know, people weren't going to have to necessarily scramble on day one to make stuff happen. Whereas, you know, if you're going to be having to publicly report, you know, here is our capability now, here's the capability we're going to develop and blah, 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 you know, that's going to make people actually have to do things. It does seem like they're kind of serious about it.
Yeah, it does. So obviously, as, this story develops and as we actually get to see some text of the actual bill, I love how they just released the press release first. You know, you sell the sizzle, right? It's very American. So they're selling the sizzle and we'll see a bill eventually. And, you know, obviously this is going to become a big issue this year. But, you know, I was kicking it around with a few people on Twitter and the US isn't exactly running like a Swiss watch right now, right? So... let's just see if they can get that one done. Now, look, staying on the topic of, encrypted services and crime and all of that, another one of these encrypted phone services for crooks looks like it managed to get itself thoroughly owned by the cops.
Yeah, this system called EncroChat, which was a vendor in Europe that was selling, you know, modified handsets and then crypto services over top. It looks like law enforcement managed to compromise or jack some domains out from under them and then were serving maybe malicious firmware or some other manner of interaction, you know, with some of the devices to try and compromise whoever was using it. There was, you know, a corresponding set of arrests and things of criminal groups around Europe that presumably were related to this. The vendor has now shut down their encrypted messaging system. They sent out a bunch of messages to their, their valuable clients and said, hey, terribly sorry, your phones are going to stop working now because all your stuff got owned or all of our stuff got owned or everybody's
stuff got owned. Apparently their clients include hitmen. So they're either pulling stumps and going to literal Belize or pulling stumps and going to figurative Belize, mm-hmm. which is much worse.
Exactly.
Where did he go? He went to Belize. He's in Belize. Yeah. Talk to me about BlueLeaks, this 270 gigabyte dump of data apparently obtained from these law enforcement fusion centres.
Yeah, so Persons Anonymous appear to have compromised or gained access to a bunch of data from a service vendor that was running, you know, kind of fusion centers, places for law enforcement agencies to exchange information in the US. This particular company ran a bunch of them as a service. You know, it's kind of like a managed service for a bunch of tenants.
Of course, it's a managed service provider that gets the cops owned, right? Like, it's gold.
The details of exactly how they got owned seem sketchy. There's talk of a file upload and then, you know, onwards from there. So, you know, presumably it was as bad as you would imagine. You know, don't ask how the managed service sausage is made. And then, yeah, a bunch of data, some 200 whatever gigs, was leaked out and then given to DDoS Secrets, which is kind of like a WikiLeaks-style data sharing sort of place. And, yeah, there's you know, the details of exactly what's in this data set, we don't really know. I mean, there's just, you know, there's discussion of lots of PII and information about, you know, cases and the sorts of things that are being shared through these fusion centers. But... you know, whether that means there's, you know, kind of data in there that supports, you know, the things that people are critical of the police agencies, you know, at the moment about, or whether it's just going to end up, you know, hurting a bunch of people rather than actually supporting, you know, the sorts of causes that you would imagine people who are hacking police stuff are currently thinking about. Some of this data apparently dates back to the mid-90s, like 1996, I think was one of the older records. So that's, you know, that's data going back a long time, and who knows what will be in there.
Well, maybe we'll finally get to the truth of Biggie and Tupac with any luck, right? So, fingers crossed. The Cybersecurity Directorate at the NSA has actually done something awesome. This is, I mean, when you read this, you just think, wow, what a perfectly sensible thing for government to be doing in terms of, you know, securing its defense ecosystem. They are going to run a managed secure DNS service for the defense industrial base. And what I just think this is a sensational idea.
Yeah, it seems really, really sensible. I mean, DNS gives you great telemetry as to what's going on in a bunch of environments in a very standardized, you know, well-parsable format. It gives you some knobs to kind of control access by blocking particular things or whatever else. And yeah, it just makes a whole bunch of sense. It makes you wonder why they hadn't done it before.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so much you can do, right? When you've got that sort of DNS capability, like if all of a sudden you see endpoints reaching out without doing a lookup first, you can be like, you know.
Yeah, and there's certainly a lot of things you can do. And we have a lot of experience with using DNS as a tool for discovery and for investigation, and yeah, all the tools for managing that are, you know, pretty mature. It's just a great place to do instrumentation. And it's one of the reasons that, you know, people who are against the DNS over HTTPS kind of thing, you know, because they traditionally would have done it in the network, now you have to do it on the server. So it's a great time to move to running your own DNS server.
Well, exactly, right? I mean, that's why I've never understood the hoo-ha, is because it's just moving it, your source of info over there, like, big deal, right?
Well, yeah, it's just some people who are used to sniffing it in the network who now don't have the ability to go and run a DNS server because, you know, they were probably not really meant to be doing it, you know, so.
Yeah.
NSA probably better position.
We had a bit of drama this week with the former US National Security Advisor and Walrus, John Bolton. He's written a tell-all book, apparently, and Paul Nakasone of Cyber Command and NSA has written a letter saying that this book exposes SIGINT sources and could irreparably harm the NSA's ability to continue to collect these things. I don't know. It doesn't really seem... You know, he sort of doesn't. This letter doesn't feel like his heart is all the way in it.
Yeah. It's almost like someone told him to do that.
Maybe because he doesn't say it will harm. This is the giveaway, right? Is when he says that it could result in the permanent loss of a valuable SIGINT source, right? He doesn't say it will. He said it could.
Yeah, that doesn't seem super convincing. I guess if you want to make up your own mind, I mean, someone was tweeting that the book's PDF had shown up in VirusTotal. So if you've got a VirusTotal sub, maybe you can go have a read.
I saw that. And I think it's already being torrented as well. Like, it's out there.
Inevitably, yeah, inevitably.
Cuckoo ka-choo. Now, the war between the United States government and Chinese telcos continues. It looks like the United States does not want a telco to land a cable from Hong Kong to the United States.
Yeah, this is the Pacific Light and Cable Network, which is kind of a, you know, a loose conglomerate of people funding a cable connecting, you know, US through Taiwan and Asia and, you know, onwards to Hong Kong. It does sound like the telecom committee that was criticized a while ago for being kind of, you know, not particularly effective at its oversight is looking for something to regulate and has, you know, it's kind of currently making noises about the Hong Kong specific leg of this cable not being a thing that they're willing to sign off on. The Taiwanese leg, apparently totally fine. But yeah, they are arguing, of course, that Hong Kong is now, you know, not really independent enough to get different treatment from the rest of China.
And that's the bit that I found interesting, actually, where they're saying there's no distinction anymore between Hong Kong and China from a policy perspective.
Yeah, and I, you know, you can kind of see their point, right? I mean, the situation in Hong Kong has been pretty hard to watch, you know, when I know a bunch of people who, you know, have lived there over the years and seeing the way that things are changing there is pretty concerning. But yeah, they appear to be, you know, deciding to flex on this particular thing, and we'll see whether that leads to, you know, a bunch of other things that relate to Hong Kong's interaction with the Western world.
So the hammer found a nail, basically, when it comes to this regulator.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Oh, this one is great. It's just more hilarity from North Korea. You know, this is the real sort of synergistic efficiency gains that we could see more of, I think, Adam. So North Korea has combined its crime operations with its espionage operations. So they will basically, you know, hack into some defense industrial base company and, you know, do some spy stuff. And then they'll try to business email compromise them on the way out to, you know, collect some of that sweet coin.
Such synergies. But hey, it makes sense, right? You're in there, you've got domain admin. I mean, you may as well go and scam some money. I mean, you could certainly imagine the, you know, the hackers working at, you know, Lazarus Group in North Korea, you know, being given, you know, here's your intelligence tasking for the day, and we need you to make $500,000 US.
Otherwise, yeah, no, it'll be like a sales target sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
I wonder if they get bonuses. It sort of cuts against the communist ethos, though, doesn't it?
Maybe the, you know, maybe the break room will have extra snacks if you, you know, make $500,000 for the great leader.
That's it. If you pull in $2 million today, we'll give you a can of lemonade. Zoom is going to now, it's reversed course and will now offer end-to-end encrypted video to everyone, including free users. But the detail that's kind of been lost in some of the reporting is that in order for you to get E2E, you need to sign up with a phone number. And that was kind of what the no E2E for free users thing was about originally, because they wanted to have credit card. They wanted to know the customer before they gave them E2E. Phone number gives you at least some level of assurance or something to peg an account to an identity. So they've decided to go ahead and do that.
Yeah, and I think this kind of makes sense. When we were saying that this was going to be about, you know, controlling abuse rather than, you know, the cost or anything else.
Exactly.
And, you know, it makes sense having a phone number. At least you've got something to give the feds as well, you know, when you're, you know, being faced with the sorts of legislation that may come down the pipe. Having anything to be able to hand over, say, hey, we did our bits, you're, you know, go do some gumshoe police work on a phone number. You know, maybe that gives them, you know, gives them something to do that doesn't involve having to then go and rip out the end-to-end they've just put in.
Amazon Web Services mitigated a 2.3 terabit per second DDoS attack back in February. And I was reading this story and apparently was some, I think it was a reflection, or they hijacked CLDAP service, CLDAP. And I'm like, what the hell is CLDAP? And apparently, like, it's LDAP, but over UDP. And I just thought, why? But yeah, they hijacked these servers. Is this a reflection attack, or did they actually own the servers? Like, how did this DDoS work?
I believe this is a reflection. The CLDAP is a thing that Microsoft domain controllers use to do some kind of discovery. So it's LDAP-like, but over UDP. So yeah, if you've got Windows domain controllers on the internet, then you could, yeah, they would have been what they were using for amplification. So yeah, I believe this was reflected AMP. UDP, LDAP.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. But 2.3 terabits. I mean, that is the new high watermark, right?
Bits.
Yeah, it's a lot of bits. But that's, I mean, Amazon can soak it, right?
So. Yeah. Well, and clearly they did, right? And that's, you know, one of the joys, I suppose, of, you know, modern scale networking is you can sync this kind of stuff and, you know, not bat too many eyelids, even at a couple of terabits.
Oracle managed to stab themselves in the face this week. Walk us through this one.
So Oracle has like an advertising tracking network thing called BlueKai, which does all the sorts of correlation, you know, of cookies and users using websites and, you know, all that kind of stuff to then go and build information for doing targeted advertising. They appear to, or one of their customers, or it's a little bit unclear, left a whole bunch of their data set lying around on the internet somewhere, and like really billions and billions millions of records, a really huge data set for users. And, you know, some people who've been looking into this, you know, have found, you know, really quite detailed data. Now, Oracle said that they, you know, the way that they package this up and give it to advertisers, they don't get all this detail, but clearly someone who had access to the raw data, you know, left it lying around. And Oracle's been pretty mum, you know, uncharacteristically, right, about exactly what's happened.
Now, this next one is a story on Cyberscoop based on some research out of ESAT, which I started reading it and thinking, oh, this is going to be lame, but it's actually pretty interesting. It looks at basically does a teardown on an APT crew's use of LinkedIn in espionage, and it is an interesting read.
Yeah, this is the Lazarus Group also, I think, out of North Korea, and they were using LinkedIn and sending people like jobs that, you know, they might be interested in, you know, with an information pack about what the job would be and the roles and that kind of thing, and then using that as the lure to try and, you know, get people to open documents and get themselves compromised. And then, you know, the article also talks through like what they did after that, like when it goes from LinkedIn to email, and then tearing down some of the accounts afterwards. But yeah, if you're interested to see how people get owned, then this is how they're doing it.
Well, I mean, I found it interesting because it's not just something that's opportunistic or occasional. I mean, it's just like standard operating procedure is to use LinkedIn as a way in, right? And I'm hearing about that more and more, particularly for documents, right? Because you can get around so many controls by delivering a malicious document to someone via LinkedIn, and Microsoft is not doing a good enough job of taking care of that.
Yeah, LinkedIn's just a really great resource for when you're targeting corporate people, right? I mean, it explains to you what their job is, how they fit into the organization, you know, gives people are used to getting unsolicited contact from recruiters, you know, through the platform. You know, people share all sorts of stuff. Like, it's just, you know, as a business social network, is exactly where you want to be when you're targeting corporate users.
We got two stories from Dan Gooden at Ars Technica this week, and they're both about malware tricks, right? Like sneaky malware tricks. One of them, though, the first one is about using Google Analytics to do exfil. It's kind of genius. I think it's cool.
Yeah, no, this is really smart. This is a bunch of carding crews doing like Magecart style scraping of card data, but then exfilling it by posting the data back to their own Google Analytics account, so then they can go and retrieve that data through the Google console rather than having to go and stash it on some rubbish C2 server where it's going to get owned. So yeah, it's smart because it hides it, you know, in traffic people expect. It's smart because it hides the volume of data that's coming out. It's smart because it lets you get it through Google, you know, with a you know, without having to run your own infrastructure. It's just, yeah, it's a cool trick. Google, I think, is probably going to shut down a few people's accounts for terms of service violations. But yeah, just a great example of, you know, sneaky malware tricks.
This next one, though, it's another just hilarious story this week, is that malware crews are using captures to prevent automated analysis of like their pages and whatnot, right? So, you know, some crawler goes to a site that could be a phishing site, and they get hit with a capture.
Yeah, this is pretty funny. They're, the groups are using, you know, captures in the style of, you know, the Google Recapture or, you know, the Cloudflare kind of load screen that you get when you're going to do a site, you know, that people are used to interacting with, and that the end users who are targets will just, you know, click through, and then automated analysis and scrapers and sandboxes and things will just be stuck there looking at the capture and getting nothing. So yeah, pretty smart move.
Yeah, we spoke about this briefly in Slack earlier today, and Sherrod DeGrippo said that they track one guy they call Captain Char, because he so apparently makes so much use of captures. So there you go. Adobe is begging the world, please uninstall Flash Player by the end of the year, because they are not going to keep patching it after, you know, in 2021, right? The support ends on December 31, 2020. I mean, they say that, but you can imagine that there will be one bug that will come along that will be so bad they'll have to do something about it. I wonder how much Flash is actually out there these days, though.
I mean, it's been a while since I've seen some Flash, but there must still be some. And I'm sure there's all sorts of, you know, old legacy systems that still need it for, you know, admin panels and dumb stuff like that. But, you know, Adobe, to their credit, do seem to be trying harder than average to kill their own software. I mean, they're talking about, you know, warning people to uninstall it and adding kill switches and stopping to support it and removing the download links so you can't even get the old versions, which, you know, there's a lot of companies that don't go to that much effort to try and protect their users. But
can they send out an auto update that actually just nukes it?
I mean, they really ought to. I hope they're going to do that. But you know, we'll start seeing, you know, people trading in, you know, black market end of life versions of Flash for things that really need it, which, you know, I guess the people who need that are probably going to get owned anyway, already are owned anyway. But, you know, at least Adobe's trying, you know, which is more than a lot of people have done.
The New Zealand government has frozen $140 million New Zealand dollars in connection to, what is this, like a Bitcoin Tumblr or something?
Yeah, this was related to Alexander Vinik, the guy who ran the BTCe exchange. He was arrested in Greece, I think, three years ago. US were trying to extradite him. The Russians also tried to extradite him. He ended up in France. Anyway, that guy and his exchange, which I think at the peak of it was handling a fairly significant amount of the bitcoins or cryptocurrencies that were going through from ransomware operators and things back in 2017.
So he wasn't a Tumblr. He was like a full exchange who anonymized.
Yeah, it was one of the exchanges that really had no attempt to validate the identity of their customers and was very well used amongst the criminal underground. I think
and this man is in jail. How strange.
I know, right, that. Although I think one of the other business associates is still in Russia, although he got scammed by the FSB out of $500 million or something of the proceeds from this. Anyway, the New Zealand government seized something like $140 million out of that was in the control of a shell company set up here in New Zealand. I presume they're going to hand that over to someone at some point. But really a pretty small drop in the bucket compared to, how much. I mean, they were handing billions as an exchange.
Wow.
And I think the proceeds of the Mt. Gox theft went through them. So, I mean, they were handling a lot of money.
We got one from Forbes here that I think is just, look, it's really good to have this on the public record because I often talk in the show about how people will get shells at a company and then sell that access onwards to like a ransomware crew or something. And so many people pull out the citation needed card, right? Because people have not spoken about this very publicly. Tom Brewster at Forbes has written up a story about some hacker who sold access to 135 companies over 3 years, netting themselves, I think, something like $1.5 million in the process.
Yeah, he was, breaking into systems in much the way that you'd expect, scanning for RDP and brute forcing creds and getting in. And then packaging it up once he'd compromised the rest of the internal systems and then selling them as a full remote access kit with support and everything. And I think they said, 3 or 4 days, tech support once you're in, to make sure you understand how to use all of the accounts and passwords and domain access that you've got. Packaging up, selling it up as a thing that, people who, then have other plans, whether they want to go and do financial fraud or whatever, can just buy and be happy in somebody else's environment without having to do the hard work.
Yeah.
And you're right, it's a story we've seen talked about a bunch, but actual concrete examples of this are pretty rare.
Well, I mean, they're rare in the public domain, but talk to anyone who works in threat intel and they'll tell you about 10 different people who, 10 different similar crews who've been doing that, right? So there is a public citation. Thank you, Tom Brewster. An arrest over a historical data breach. On June 16, a 29-year-old named Justin Sean Johnson was arrested in Michigan in connection to a breach of a whole bunch of health data back in 2013 and 2014.
Yeah, this guy actually worked at the Federal Emergency Management Agency as an Oracle PeopleSoft admin. He broke into the PeopleSoft install at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, stole a whole bunch of personal data, and then was selling that on the dark web to people doing tax fraud and that kind of thing, which, pretty scummy set of life choices. It does look like he was also involved with thefts from in the similar style, selling personal information on the dark web after that. So, yeah, good to see this guy wrapped up.
Yeah, well, he'll probably be doing a little bit of time if we had to guess. A Chrome extension with 33 million downloads apparently was hoovering up all sorts of user data. That's another one from Dan Gooden at Ars.
Yeah, this was a set of extensions by Israeli-based company Galcom, which purported to do a whole bunch of things, but would then later on in their life, download extra executable code and do who knows what. Google has been wrapping up these ones for being kind of sketchy, but it's just, the number of times we've seen this story repeated is too damn high.
This one via Catalin Kimpanu. Apparently Microsoft is saying that the COVID-19 malware attacks that were much hyped in the media were barely a blip in terms of total malware volume. I've had a chat to a couple of people about this and they say, yeah, okay, sure. If you compare it to just all malware, it was barely a blip. But if you look at the most active crews, the ones who know that they were doing, they really did jump on the COVID-19 stuff as a lure and they did it more than any other lure that they've ever seen. So I think this story is a bit misleading.
Yeah, I mean, clearly in the end, whatever works, and the COVID lures were being very effective. I mean, we saw it being used by all sorts of different crews. The stats are a bit kind of janky looking because, I'm sure a lot of people, were very keen to click on them.
Yeah, it looks like that's settling down now. Russia has unbanned Telegram, which means if you live in Russia, you probably shouldn't use Telegram.
Yeah, they've announced some cooperation with the Russian government to provide the necessary, whatever that is, to the FSB to support our continued operation of resumed operation of Telegram in Russia. It's funny because the ban on Telegram actually meant that a bunch of Russian politicians and people who didn't want to be monitored would use it because they figured that it must be safe. But yeah, maybe now not so much.
Yeah, Facebook is suing websites that sold Instagram likes and scraped Facebook user data, according to another one from Catalan here.
Yeah, we've seen a whole flurry of court cases from Facebook going after people who are using their platforms for various dodgy stuff. I mean, it's sort of group.
That's the thing, right? On its own, this story isn't that interesting, but you add it to the stuff where they're suing all these registrars for offering, for maintaining these shady domains for God knows who, and it seems like this is a real strategy by Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly looks that way. I mean, there's at the bottom of Catalan's article is actually a timeline of a bunch of the other cases. And yeah, when you see them lined up like that, it's pretty clear that this is a specific choice to go and scare people away from using their platform.
Yeah, we'll lawyer you to death, basically, is their idea. We've got a funny one here from Joe Cox over at Vice Motherboard, which is just really a look into the grey market for stolen in-game Roblox items. The reason I think this is worth talking about is it's just proof that, basically if you're running an online business, even if it's a video game with valuable in-game items, you're just going to wind up with a criminal underground popping up around it. It doesn't matter what you do, criminals will come in.
Yeah, and this is actually a story about an underground marketplace for buying and selling these products that was itself breached, and then a bunch of the data about who was buying what and all that kind of thing leaked out of there. But, if you will trade in illicit Roblox items, then, I guess you should probably, take precautions.
There you go. So not only will you attract the forums that attract the criminals, but you'll attract criminals who will hack those forums. Exactly. And did that data then wind up on another forum?
Inevitably, which will probably also get shelled. So.
Yes, exactly.
Just shelled all the way down.
Oh, man. The Daily Swig is reporting on a Starbucks database hack that got paid a bug bounty. But you look at how they managed to get into the Starbucks customer loyalty database and you just weep salty tears.
Yeah, the write-up from this particular bug bounty hunter is pretty good, actually. It's well-written, well-explained. But yeah, essentially they path-traversed in a proxy that was making back-end requests and then were from there able to find the Microsoft Graph API that just had all the customer details in it and you could just search them and dump them all out. And so I don't think they dumped all the customers. They just used the count command to figure out how many there would be had they dumped it, and it was something like 100 million. So getting $4,000 worth of bounty for that, they could have made more if they'd actually nicked the data.
Yeah, I mean, I actually did see that and thought, holy crap, 4K seems a little bit low when they managed to just slash their way around Starbucks' database. But anyway.
To be fair, they did have a WAF bypass, which involved using, instead of .//.////. Oh, WAF didn't think of that.
There you go. Now, of course, the Philadelphia Inquirer wrote up a great story about an OSINT, the cops using OSINT investigations to track down a woman who was caught on camera, a masked woman who was caught on camera torching a few cop cars during the recent unrest in the United States. And it's a really interesting read, right, about how they noticed she was wearing a pretty distinctive T-shirt, realized you could only buy it from Etsy, and then looked at people who reviewed her on Etsy and then unpacked more social media profiles from there and then compared tattoos that you can see that the woman has and blah, 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 blah. But it's just, this is what internet shoe leather detective work looks like now.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty classic OSINT story. And, clearly the Philadelphia cops have been, reading a bit of Bellingcat or something and brushing up on their techniques. So, I mean, I guess good job. On the other hand, if you're going to go out and do anarchy, maybe don't leave product reviews of your outfit on Etsy while you're doing it. That's probably the main takeaway.
But I don't think it's mentioned in this story, but what she's been charged with, I think she's looking at it's a long time in prison. It's 10 or 20 years, right?
Oh, jeez.
And, I'm not an advocate for torching cop cars, but I'm also not an advocate for putting people away for decades for setting fire to a car. It is ultimately, it is a car, okay?
So yeah.
It's not.
Yeah. Oh, jeez.
Yeah, and I think they've been charged federally too. So it's they're in a lot of trouble. this next one, another one from Catalan. There's some Samsung Blu-ray players out there that are just rebooting in a loop. Nobody knows why. And, Catalan asks in this story whether or not it is a botched firmware update or maybe an expired certificate.
An expired certificate does seem more plausible. I don't imagine Samsung would push firmware updates out to anything unless they absolutely had to, and Blu-ray players probably not on that list. But yeah, failed SSL cert, you know, it's expired and bricked it. That sounds totally believable. So yeah, I guess it's just the consumer electronics future we signed up for, isn't it?
I got to tell a very quick story, Adam, which is one day you sent me a screenshot of your calendar with a note in it that said somewhere a certificate expires. And you spent that day sweating bullets because you could not remember what certificate you were talking about. And you'd put that note into your calendar, like, I think nearly 2 years prior, right? So, yes. Yeah, you figured it out in the end, though, didn't you?
I think I did in the end figure out what it was. And in the end, it wasn't mine. It was somebody else's, like it was a customer or something. But yeah, that was, I mean, Past Metal was such a to not put what it was. Yeah. Not even a hint.
Yeah, it's like the whole Jerry Seinfeld thing with like last night guy, you know, last night guy. Last night Jerry really screwed over today, Jerry.
Exactly.
Oh, that was great. Anyway, moving on. Oh, great write-up here looking at the experience of Maersk during the NotPetya attack, written by Maersk's former identity and access management expert.
Yeah, this is a really, really interesting story because, I mean, looking at these big ransomware in the case of Maersk and NotPetya, not even ransomware, just like straight up sabotage, you know, looking at these cases from the outside, you imagine it would be really horrid to be on the ground and in the middle of and what it's like to deal with that and having someone, you know, give a first-hand account of what it was like, we know, with enough backstory and context to understand the organization. So, yeah, it's just really insightful to see. And the guy has also now left Maersk, so I guess he can be a little bit more free about what he is saying and has some good advice for organizations, you know, to, you know, presumably not go through the same amount of disruption that Maersk did. And, you know, some pretty real talk in there for anyone who has to deal with, you know, the corporate politics as well as all of the IT and technical stuff, you know, thinking about how identity and networks work for modern organizations. So yeah, absolutely worth the read for anyone, you know, in this industry, I think.
It's very long. I only had a chance to read enough of it to realize that I should read the whole thing. So it's definitely on my list, but I haven't got through all of it yet. Now, look, before we go, I just want to talk about this really weird story. It was initially broken by the BBC and then it kind of did the rounds, right? And I mean, it even wound up being reported by TechCrunch, by Zach Whitaker over there. And it says, you know, the headline is Twitter says some business users had their private data exposed. But really what they're talking about, I mean, it's not that.
So yeah, TechCrunch is reporting that Twitter customers, where people who are, you know, business customers of Twitter, like advertisers and things, have had a bunch of their information compromised. But it seems to be saying that the data in question is like stored in a browser cache, you know, of an authenticated user for too long. And if they, I don't know, logged into Twitter's management systems from a public library, then maybe 4 digits of credit card numbers are left in a browser cache after you log out. Like, that doesn't seem particularly serious.
I was rubbing my temples reading this. Why? Why is this a story?
Yeah, I'm confused. Like, of all the things that can go wrong in the modern internet world, this really did seem pretty low down the list.
Yeah, so that was a real weird one. But yeah, I would not call that a security incident for sure. Adam, that is actually it for this week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us, my friend, and we're going to do it all again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat, and I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with the check of the week's security news headlines. Big thanks to him for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Pascal Podvin of Casada. Casada was founded right here in Australia and has grown at a very rapid clip. So much so that InQtel jumped on board last year for their Series A, and they just nailed down a $10 million Series B this month. Casada started off with a simple idea, using a proof-of-work-based system to make automating things like content scraping and cred stuffing too computationally intensive for the attackers to keep bothering with, basically. So just make it expensive for the attackers. They found early success working with companies that operated out of countries where traffic was very expensive, but it wasn't long before they were able to scale up their operation to be competitive basically everywhere. Pascal Podvin is Casada's chief executive officer. He joined the company last year, and he is our sponsor guest this week. As you'll hear, he says there's a reason a small upstart like Casada has been able to come in and slay the CDN giants in bot mitigation. Because they bill for traffic, he says, they have no incentive to actually reduce synthetic activity. He joined me for this interview, and here's what he had to say.
Bot mitigation is not a new concept. However, I think that the way that terminology itself is actually masking the reality behind the synthetic traffic problem. And that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about an environment, we're talking about a world, an online world, where automated users, automated traffic has become overwhelming. So in 2019, for instance, which is just a year ago, the measures were that more than 20% of the internet traffic worldwide was generated not just by bots, but by malicious bots. Last year, 40% of all login attempts were generated by malicious bots.
To be honest, I'm actually surprised that's not higher, given the number of for just general traffic, right? That's a very high figure. But for login attempts, I just would have thought, given the amount of cred stuffing we see, I would have thought that most login attempts are actually fraudulent.
Okay, so to your point, I think everybody has been focusing on that, and it is a big problem, obviously, right? And it's a problem that's not going away. Fraudulent login. Attempts and financial institutions, for instance, are going up year after year. And so everybody's been focusing on this. And the bot mitigation tools that have been available for a few years now have been mostly focusing on that. That's great, and it's important, and Casada is doing this as well. But from the very beginning, we have been as well architecting our solution in order to deal with a much more insidious and dangerous type of problem, which is where the market is shifting, which is really related to the unwanted, unsolicited, sometimes illegal appropriation of data to the detriment of the company that is being targeted.
I mean, that's just a very fancy way of saying scrapers, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think what is really important about that is that it is posing a type of problem that goes way beyond the login fraud type of issues. We're talking about stock value manipulation. We're talking about the inability of an enterprise to compete because their prices are being scraped and adjusted by their competitors within a short amount of time.
Yeah, so that's things like travel websites, which I'm guessing aren't doing a roaring trade right now. But this is stuff that we've spoken about previously, although we haven't spoken about the stock manipulation example. Can you give us some detail on that?
Yeah, I mean, we have discovered, for instance, with some of our customers that some funds were scraping enough information to be able to reconstitute the earnings of our customer and play the stock market before they were actually releasing their official results, because they knew exactly what the results were going to be. There is a term that designates the source of data. They call that alternative source of data, right? And that's exactly what is happening. So my point is, bot mitigation tools designate something that occupies an obscure corner of the toolbox of a CISO. But the reality of the problem is that it's a boardroom problem. It's a C-level business executive problem. It's a problem of online traffic integrity and online business optimization. And that's really what Casada has been trying to do, coming up with a solution that is much simpler, smarter, more cost-effective than anything that's been built in the past. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why the company is so successful.
I got to admit to being surprised that CDN companies like Cloudflare and other companies like Akamai and whatnot, it surprises me that they haven't come in and really tried to crush you guys yet.
Well, I think they're trying, both on an efficacy standpoint and cost effectiveness. I think it's easy. I mean, it's been easy for us to defeat them. And I'm not sure there's not a conflict of interest, right, in addition to this. I mean, specifically coming from CDN players, you know, I'm not sure if their business model is not predicated upon the management of a very large traffic. If you kill the synthetic traffic part of it, then maybe you shoot yourself in the foot. I'm not 100% sure that this is a problem for them.
I think I think you just managed to out-cynical me, which is amazing.
99% of our customers do have a CDN, and you know who the 800-pound gorilla is in the segment, and yet they're working with us, right? They're working with us for a reason.
You tend to deploy between the origin and the CDN, right?
That's absolutely correct. And that way of deploying the solution has many benefits that some organizations do not necessarily realize. It has obviously a huge benefit in terms of our ability to obfuscate our solution. That's not the only the only benefit that relates to obfuscation, obviously. It also has the benefit of seeing a lot of pretty much all the online traffic, which puts us in a position to provide analytics to our customers that are immensely rich. And when we're talking about optimizing your online business, obviously analytics play a key role in that.
Well, you'd pick up a lot of good intel too when you're seeing that much traffic just for your own use.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. But I mean, few customers have a clear understanding of what their synthetic traffic is, which type of attacks are under, which types of attacks are persistent, who is coming back, where are the attacks coming from, etc. If you do provide that intel, then obviously you help customers optimize their online business, do a better job at segmenting their customers, have a better understanding of what their drop rates are, what are the conversion rates, what are they really, right? If you make abstraction of all the synthetic traffic, then all of a sudden you have a much clearer vision of your online traffic. Now, in a world where online for many businesses has become the only viable channel, for some of them the only channel, and an environment where cost suddenly matters a lot more than it did just a few weeks or a few months ago, that's a great benefit to provide.
Now, I'm curious to know if there's much variation in bot activity between different markets and regions, or is it all pretty uniform? Or I'd imagine there would be crews targeting different regions, right? Like you might see more of this in the United States than you might see in Germany, for example.
Yeah, and as a general rule, you're absolutely right. But none of that stuff is static at all.
It moves around a bit.
The variations are pretty intense. Yes, absolutely.
And in terms of like growth, where are you seeing the most growth in your business?
United States, no question. That's where the problem is the most prevalent. That's where you find the largest organizations, and the size of the market itself is just humongous. So yes, you do need to be successful in the US, and then you can envision the rest of the world.
All right, Pascal Podvin, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a bit of a chat about what's new up at Casada, and congratulations on your Series B. It was a pleasure to chat to you.
A pleasure. Same here. Thanks a lot, Pat.
That was Pascal Podvin there of Casada. Big thanks to him for that. And you can find Casada at casada.io. That's casada.io. And that's it from me this week. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I'll be back next week with more information security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.